So I'm going to follow in Surita's footsteps to begin with, at least to begin with, and start the talk this afternoon with a poem. And I'll give you a bit of context. It's one of Bhante's poems. It's called Lumbini. And Lumbini is the birthplace of the Buddha. You probably all are aware of that. And the poem was written in 1951, and that was a couple of years, maybe a little bit more, somewhere between 1947 and 1949. Bhante visited Lumbini on pilgrimage with his friend Satchipriya. And he describes in his memoirs having mixed feelings about his visit to Lumbini. On the one hand, he was overjoyed to have visited the place where the Buddha was born. He said he could feel a kind of spiritual atmosphere or current there at Lumbini. But at the same time, he expressed his regret and even outrage at the condition of Lumbini and the fact that the shrine that was there, the Ashoka column that had formerly stood there, was in a state of disrepair. And the shrine was actually looked after by a small Hindu woman who thought that she was tending a Hindu shrine, didn't realize it was a Buddhist holy place at all. So there was a sense of outrage there. And then a couple of years later, 1951, he wrote this poem. So let's start with the poem. I remember a pool of blue lotuses blooming at Lumbini near the dusty high road. And the miracle of those blue flowers rising so purely from the black waters told me far more of the birth of the Enlightened One than the broken Ashoka column or ruined shrine. It's a very short poem, but a very beautiful poem, and I think we've got there a very strong image. So this image of lotuses blooming beside a dusty road, or lotuses blooming even amongst ruins and fragments of something of former glory. So a strong image, a powerful image, evocative image, and I think an image that is particularly relevant to us. It's an image we can really do something with, a metaphor that we can really do something with. Personally, I think that image captures something about the spirit of the order. If you remember on the first evening, I was talking about that indefinable spirit of the order that we all have to try and catch. And I think it's an image like this that can communicate something of that spirit to us. So as modern 21st century Westerners, or at least people living in a Western country in the 21st century, we do live amongst ruins. You could say we live amongst ruins and fragments. So in his lecture, The Journey to Il Convento, Bhante said that we inhabit a world of broken images. A world of broken images. And he said that in relation to traditional Western culture. So particularly traditional Christian Western culture. We inhabit a world of broken images because the symbols, the archetypes, the mythology that people hundreds of years ago would have had no problem kind of identifying with and understanding and responding to. For us as modern 21st century Westerners, we don't have that same response to those particular images, those particular myths, and those particular symbols. If you like, they're broken for us. The tradition has been broken. So we're bereft of the mythology that people would have quite easily connected with centuries ago. So that's true of Western culture. I think it's also true in relation to Eastern Buddhist culture, or Eastern Buddhism generally speaking. In a sense, as Westerners, we're picking up fragments from an Eastern culture and an Eastern tradition. Satyaraja mentioned it in his talk that what Bhante did was to take what was available to him in terms of the Buddhist tradition and try to make sense of the pieces that he was discovering around him. And some of that was, you know, some of the tradition was, in a sense, lifeless or had lost its vitality, lost its spiritual vitality. So what Bhante has done is he's taken those broken images, those fragments, from two traditions, from the Western culture and from the Eastern culture, and brought something together, put those fragments together in some kind of way that demonstrates the life that is in them, or helps us to identify the life that is in them. So the order has grown out of that context. It's grown out of a context of broken fragments and ruins. The order, you could say, is a lotus emerging from those broken pieces and those broken fragments. I think we can also apply this image to ourselves, to our own subjective experience. So I think it was in the talk on the weekend, for those of you who were here, I was talking about this traditional Buddhist term, samvega, the shock, the dismay and the disappointment that we have in relation to samsara. At some point we experience a shock, there's dismay, there's disappointment, life lets us down. Or what we thought was possible within samsara, we begin to see it's not the case. And that shocks us, that disappoints us. So in a sense, our own subjective experience has been to some extent shattered. It's somehow in pieces. What we thought samsara might be able to deliver us or give us, to some extent that is broken. That is in pieces. We might have broken dreams. We might look back over our lives and see that certain dreams or illusions that we held have been broken. Ideas we had about ourselves, versions of ourselves from the past, no longer hold up and are broken. So we might all be able to relate to the image on that basis, but also to be able to see that there's life there. There's still life within us, or life trying to grow within us. There's still, even if it's just the seed or the smallest shoot, there's something within those pieces of our former ideas, our former views about ourselves, that is trying to grow and trying to push through. And that must be the case, or none of us would be sat in this room. So as an image that relates to our own subjective experience, I think we've got something here. And lastly, I think this particular image of a lotus blooming amongst the ruins can communicate something to us that's really important about enlightenment, which is the topic that we're turning our minds to this afternoon. That seems to be what Bhante is trying to communicate in this poem more directly. The pure lotus emerging from the black waters is showing us more about the life of the Buddha. It's telling us more about the Buddha than the broken Ashoka column or the ruined shrine. So the ruined shrine here, we could take that as symbolic of our ideas about enlightenment, our assumptions about enlightenment. We've all got ideas about enlightenment. We need ideas about enlightenment. Bhante used to speak of having an operational concept. So we need some kind of concept of what enlightenment is, so that it's out there, so to speak, or it's ahead of us. And then we know kind of the direction of travel, where it is we're going to. So we do need ideas about enlightenment, and we need to make sure they're good ideas about enlightenment, that they're conceptually sound, that they do work for us, and as much as is possible conceptually, give us a sense of what we're moving towards. So we do need that, and I would recommend having a look at the three jewels and the section on the goal, where Bhante talks about different ways of describing enlightenment conceptually, whether that's in terms of what enlightenment is the absence of, what it's the presence of. He talks about paradox and he talks about symbol. So really helping us get conceptually clear about what enlightenment is. But what we have to realise is that all of those concepts are provisional. So as useful as they are, as necessary as they are, as vital as they are, they're all provisional. You cannot capture fully what enlightenment is purely through conceptual expression. And Buddhism recognizes that, so the Buddhist tradition has a critique of its own ideas, a critique of its own concepts, always trying to make sure that they don't inhibit actually seeing the truth of things, that we don't just stick to the concept and not see beyond it. And some aspects of the Buddhist tradition, as you know, deliberately try to destroy our concepts, pull the rug out from under our feet. The Diamond Sutra is a great example of that, isn't it? The sutra that cuts like a diamond. It's trying to shatter what we think. It's trying to shatter our kind of wholehearted belief in our concept, trying to break through that. In a sense, to go back to the image, reduce our concepts to rubble, reduce our concepts to a pile of stones. And that's telling us that there is more to, there's more that is required of us than a merely intellectual and conceptual understanding, as important as that is. So there's something then about enlightenment that goes beyond reason. Reason alone can't fully grasp enlightenment, can't attain enlightenment. There's something that is beyond it. Another way of talking about that would be to say that there's something about enlightenment that is secret. There's something about enlightenment that's hidden. And the traditional term for that would be guhya. So there's something about enlightenment that is guhya. So when this is particularly prominent in the Vajrayana tradition, talking about things as guhya, secret or hidden. It doesn't just mean they're secret or hidden in the superficial sense of not talking about them because they're too special or certain people aren't ready to hear them. It's not just that. Things are guhya according to the Vajrayana tradition because it's almost impossible to talk about them. Things are guhya because they're matters of experience. An experience, you know, our unique human experience, is very, very difficult to put into words and to describe. We do it, we have to do it, because of the need to communicate that experience, but it's not always amenable to words. Bhante's translation of guhya is cave of the heart, which I think is particularly good. There are certain aspects of our experience that are, if you like, in the cave of our hearts, and it's very difficult to actually communicate that adequately to somebody else. So I think this aspect of enlightenment, to call it that, is represented by the lotus. So if the ruins are a symbol for our deposed concepts, our former operational concept of enlightenment that we're having to evolve, the lotus then is a symbol of the secret or the hidden, the guhya nature of enlightenment. Something mysterious, something beautiful that grows when our concepts kind of remove the veil from our eyes, when our concepts are removed. So I think that's why Bhante, or that's what we can take from what Bhante is saying in terms of seeing the lotus and it telling us more about the birth of the Buddha than the ruined shrine. We could say that the lotus as an image is telling us more about enlightenment than our merely conceptual understandings of what enlightenment is. So I'm saying all this at the beginning just to make the point that ultimately enlightenment is something ineffable, indescribable, something that is very difficult to talk about. And I think by extension that includes any discussion about the third ordination, acceptance verse or vow. For the attainment of enlightenment, I accept this ordination. It's very hard to talk about this third vow. It's hard to do it, and it's hard to talk about it. It is guhya. And just reflecting on this vow personally, in the last couple of days, I wouldn't say I think about it. You know, I don't very often think about whether I'm moving towards enlightenment or attaining enlightenment. I don't think in those terms. It's just something I'm doing. I'm sort of confident I'm doing it and I'm living out this third vow. But it's not like I consciously and rationally kind of gauge my progress in relation to the third vow, if you see what I mean. It's something that I am just confident is happening, and I am, to the best of my ability, you know, trying to live up to this third vow. And I think that's a better way of approaching it, actually, and thinking about it, is more in terms of how it's lived, how it's acted out and acted upon, rather than thinking of it purely in conceptual terms or giving it, in a sense, too much prominence in our thinking process. And if we think of it in these terms as something that is lived out, in terms of how we do it, it has to bring us to a living example. And to bring us to a living example means to bring us to the person of the Buddha. So if we want to know how to practice this third ordination acceptance verse, if we want to get more of a sense of how to live out this verse, we need to turn to the person of the Buddha and the example of the Buddha. So him as the embodiment of enlightenment. Bhante once said, I think it's in one of his books of aphorisms, that there's no such thing as enlightenment, there are only enlightened beings. So if we want to know what enlightenment is and how to move towards it, we need to look at the being that has both realized it or has made significant progress in terms of moving towards it. So that's what we're going to do. That's what I'm going to do in this talk, is look at the example, look at the Buddha and the example of the Buddha. In a way, it might be better to think of this third vow, rather than for the attainment of enlightenment, to think of it in terms of to be like the Buddha or to emulate the Buddha. I accept this ordination. That might capture it a little bit better for us, practically speaking. So what we're going to do is I'm going to turn now towards a sutta. And it's the Arya Pariyasana Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. And in the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, essentially what we've got is the Buddha describing his own progress towards enlightenment and his own attainment of enlightenment. So we'll look at the sutta, and I'm going to draw out five practical points that we can take from the sutta that might help us in our understanding of this third vow, and ultimately how to live that out in our lives when everybody's ordained. So just to say initially, the Arya Pariyasana is usually translated as the noble quest. So Arya is noble, Pariyasana or Asana is quest. Quest, search or pursuit are the usual translations. Bhante has made the point that you could also translate it as urge, will or desire. So the urge, the will or the desire for that which is noble. And as I said again in the talk at the weekend, is even spoken somewhere in terms of having a craze for enlightenment. So asana is kind of passion, desire, even a craze for that which is noble. Maybe we could think of the third vow in those terms. With desire for the noble, I accept this ordination. With a craze for enlightenment, I accept this ordination. Brings out something of the more ecstatic quality of this verse. Okay, so let's look then at the Arya Pariyasana Sutta. And you're probably all familiar with it, even if you're not sure where it's coming from, because it's basically the Buddha, as I say, giving the story of his life. So we've got a very simple beginning. So the Buddha is with Ananda, and they're at Sarvati in the Jetta's Grove in Anathapindika's park. And they're just going about their usual daily routine, arms round, eating together. They end up bathing together. And Ananda's had some discussions with some bhikkhus who are living nearby, who've said that they haven't seen the Buddha for quite a long time. It would be really good if the Buddha could come and give them a teaching. And, you know, they kind of ask Ananda to have a word with the Buddha and see if they can, he can persuade him to go and visit them. So Ananda very kind of gently makes this suggestion to the Buddha that there's a group of bhikkhus nearby and maybe it would be good if the Tathagata would go and visit them. And the Buddha accepts that and goes to see this group of bhikkhus gathered together talking about the Dharma. And when the Buddha enters into their dwelling place and engages them in conversation, he gives them a very clear teaching. He gives them the teaching on the two types of search. And he says to them, bhikkhus, there are these two types of search, these two types of quest. There's the noble quest and there's the ignoble quest. And then he goes on to describe what each of them consists in. So the ignoble search is just to put it in my own words, is when one who is subject to conditioned processes, so when one who's subject to birth, old age, sickness, death, etc., etc., goes in search of that which is also subject to those processes. So someone who is subject to old age, sickness, death, seeks happiness in that which is also subject to old age, sickness, and death. So he says that is the ignoble search. And he gives various examples, wife and children, fowl and pigs, elephants, cattle, horses, gold and silver. They're all subject to those processes. They're all impermanent. So if one searches for happiness in those areas, one's doomed. Then he says the noble search, by contrast, is when one who's subject to those processes seeks happiness, seeks satisfaction in that which is not subject to those processes. So seeks happiness in that which is unborn, undying, unaging, the deathless nirvana, basically. So these two types of search. Now I have to say I find that refreshingly simple. It's this or it's that. It's noble or it's ignoble. It's enlightenment or it's ignorance. It's good just to have something very clear and black and white, isn't it? It's this or it's that. We're very good at nuance, aren't we, and subtlety and interpretation. And rightly so. You know, we have to take a subtle, nuanced approach to our spiritual life. One of the main things we all need to do is find the conditions that actually support our spiritual development, our spiritual growth. That's a very delicate matter and does require subtlety and nuance. We'll be doing that for years and years, trying to find the most effective conditions we've got to deepen our going for refuge. But at the same time, the danger with our subtlety and interpretation is that we do rationalise our desires. So it's very easy to rationalise a desire as something to do with the subtlety of the conditions we need to progress towards enlightenment. So a teaching like this, the simplicity of it, the benefit of having a question like that, is it noble or is it ignoble? Is it moving us towards enlightenment or deeper into ignorance? Is that it cuts through our tendency to rationalise our desires. So I think this is the first of the 5 points. We really need to be honest with ourselves. This has come up on previous days. So the first thing in terms of practicing this third ordination vow, be honest. So Surita mentioned yesterday Bhante's 2 sets of 15 points. One of the 15 points for old and new order members, I think, is don't misuse the developmental model. Don't misuse the developmental model. So that means don't rationalise something that you want in terms of it being good for your spiritual development. You know, be honest with yourself about that. He gives the example of someone saying that they'd like a 3-month holiday in Greece because it will be good for their spiritual development. Rather than just saying, I want a holiday in Greece and I'd like it to be a long one. Sometimes we dress it up in those clothes, don't we? I'm going to do this because it will be good for my spiritual development. There's nothing wrong with a holiday, and it might be that at times a holiday is good for our spiritual development, but let's not rationalise something that is purely a desire or something we want in spiritual language. So if we are slipping into that, we need to be prepared to question that and be prepared to have that questioned. So be on the lookout for that and allow others to comment on that. So being honest with ourselves, being honest with other people, and really exploring if what we're doing and what we're pursuing is part of the noble quest or if it's part of the ignoble quest. And the reason that's so important is because it's so easy for us to slip back. So you all know this, but Bhante's talked about the gravitational pull of the conditioned, hasn't he? Let's not forget that ordination is not stream entry. It's not synonymous with stream entry and irreversibility. You're putting in a lot of work now to make that shift from provisional to effective going for refuge, learning how to put conditions in place to make your going for refuge increasingly effective. But that's all reversible. So after ordination, you've got to be particularly vigilant that you don't slip back from effective going for refuge into provisional going for refuge. That's happened. That's probably happened quite a lot. I remember being on my Guhyaloka course and being shocked one day when we found in the library some pictures of previous Guhyaloka courses. And we took them out all enthusiastic, looking through them at all the order members. And Arta Priya just walked up, looked over our shoulder and started to comment on the different pictures and say, oh yeah, he resigned, never seen him since his ordination. He was around doing really well, but don't hear of him much anymore. And there were page after page where that was the case. And I remember that was shocking. And, you know, I was there all inspired after my own ordination, thinking I was going to fly and, you know, just go on and on, being inspired, etc., etc. But realizing that, well, that could easily happen to me. I could leave here, and despite all this inspiration, I could be one of those people that in 5 years or 10 years, someone's looking through the book and they say, oh yeah, Padmasagara, he was great for a couple of years. Never heard of him since then. So I made a pact with myself then that I wouldn't become one of those people. So far, so good. That was 6 years ago. But don't be one of those people. Make sure after you're ordained that you keep putting the conditions in place that are part of the noble search and not the ignoble search. Don't rationalize desire. Be honest with yourself and be honest with other people. Okay, so that's the first point. And that relates to the Buddha giving this discourse to the bhikkhus on the two types of search. And that's the only conceptual teaching the Buddha gives in this particular discourse directly. The rest of it is his life story. So it's almost as if the Buddha's saying, if you want to know what the noble search looks like, it's me. You know, it's my life. I'm not going to tell you that anymore in conceptual terms. Here's the example. So he describes how when he was young, he asked himself that question. It was a deep questioning. Why, when I'm subject to these processes, am I seeking happiness in that which is also subject to them? What if I tried something else? What if I went in search of nirvana? And then he goes on to describe his going forth. So he describes how, while still young, this is reading directly from the text, while still young, a black-haired young man, endowed with the blessing of youth, in the prime of life, though my mother and father wished otherwise, and wept with tearful faces, I shaved off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and went forth from home life into homelessness. It's a very stripped back, simple description of the Buddha's going forth then. No chariots or anything like that. He just decided that's what he was going to do, confronted his parents and their grief around that, went forth anyway, shaved off his hair, put on the yellow robe and went forth. And we'll see that as the life story unfolds, the Buddha's going forth doesn't ever stop. It's a continual process. And that's something that we can take on as well. So the second point in terms of practicing this third vow is to keep alive the spirit of going forth. Keep the spirit of going forth alive. And going forth was something that was dear to Bhante's heart. You can tell that because he gave several talks about going forth, particularly on the anniversary of his own going forth. So he went forth on the 18th of August 1947, burning his passport, putting on the rag robes and going forth with his friend. And then 50 years later, there's a talk, 1997, Reflections on My Going Forth. 10 years later, 2007, another talk on Reflections on My Going Forth. And so it was obviously something he was thinking about 50 and 60 years after the event and still exploring the significance of his going forth. I just want to dwell on the 1997 talk briefly and draw out a couple of points from that. It's very interesting because he talks about going forth in terms of going forth in body, speech and mind. So going forth in body, speech and mind. So some of what I'm about to say is from that talk, other points are from elsewhere, and some of it is my own reflection. So in terms of going forth in body, Bhante in the talk, he describes this as going forth from our usual conditions and our usual environment. So literally taking your body and putting it somewhere else constitutes a going forth in body. So he's talking specifically about retreats. So I think as order members, if we want to live out this third vow, regular retreats are vital. It's sort of easy in the ordination process. You might not think it's easy in the ordination process, but all the retreats you need to do are kind of laid out for you. You've got all these themes going for refuge retreat themes. I don't know how many there are, somewhere between 8 and 10 probably. So over several years, you know what retreats to do. You know which ones you've done, which ones you haven't. It's all there as a kind of path. After ordination, that pretty much stops. You know, it's over to you to make sure that you're getting on retreat regularly and doing the right kind of retreats that will help you after ordination. So do make sure that you are thinking in terms of regular retreats and also solitary retreats. So Bhante used to say that all order members should do a month of solitary retreat every year. Whether he meant all in one block or two-week retreats, I don't know. But that was his recommendation, a month of solitary retreats each year. So that again, constitutes a going forth in body, really going out into a wild place, so to speak, spending time alone. But more than that, Bhante talks about pioneering and going overseas. So you can go forth in body by going to another country, trying to live in a culture that's not your own, using a different language. It's always interesting when you hear stories of people who've either done that or are looking to do that. Some people in the room have done that. Thinking of Claudio, 5 months here at Padmaloka, out of his home in Mexico, in England for the first time. Yeah, he's gone forth in body, coming to Padmaloka. So it is something we can do. In a sense, we're emulating the Buddha going forth into the forest, into the unknown. So then there's going forth in speech. We don't often think of going forth in this way, do we, in terms of our speech? Bhante, in that 97 talk, he says that he thinks often we speak too much, and a going forth in speech might be to experience more silence. But also I think we can think, and perhaps it's more helpful to think in these terms, of going forth in speech as being going forth from contact to communication. So going forth from mere contact, which would be just the exchange of information, ideas, contact on a fairly superficial level, into communication, a kind of deep communication, what Bhante described elsewhere as a vital mutual responsiveness. So a vital mutual responsiveness on the basis of a common ideal. So coming together in dialogue and communication on the basis of going for refuge, a shared exploration of the spiritual world, going for refuge. And I think all Bhante's his lectures, his writing about communication, I think is particularly profound. It, to me, seems to be suggesting that communication is in itself a path. It's an aspect of spiritual friendship, isn't it? And he's emphasised very much the importance of spiritual friendship. But communication, we could say, is a path. And the Vajrayana tradition brings this out in its teaching on the three lineages of the Dharma transmission. Three lineages of Dharma transmission. So one of those is the word lineage, and this is the lowest, the kind of hierarchical. So there's the word lineage of the acharyas. So the acharyas are teachers well versed in scripture. So they communicate through words, through concepts, and it's possible to transmit the Dharma through words and concepts. So there's that lineage. Then there's the sign lineage, or the you could call it the symbol lineage. So this is the lineage, the communication of the vidyadharas. tantric masters with high spiritual attainment. So they communicate by gesture or by symbol. And the classic example is the Buddha holding up the flower to Mahakashyapa. So communicating something, let's say, the content of enlightenment through symbols. But then higher than that, there's the mind lineage of the Buddhas. So a direct mind-to-mind transmission of the Dharma. I've got no idea what that means, but it sounds good. And that's the highest of these three levels of transmission of the Dharma. So it suggests, doesn't it, that our communication can go really, really deep. Can go deep in all kinds of ways, not just through what we say and the words we speak, but the symbols, the gesture, even the way we can have mind-to-mind communication. So I think communication is a whole path. So going forth in speech, in a sense, is endless. There's always more going forth we can do in terms of speech and communication. And then lastly, there's the going forth in mind. So Bhante speaks of this in terms of going forth from vijnana to jnana. So from vijnana, which is divided awareness, to jnana, which is undivided, non-dual awareness. So seeing a unity rather than division, rather than seeing things as fixed, independently existing entities, there is seeing things in terms of unity. So there's loads that could be said about that, kind of philosophically, metaphysically. I'm not going to go there. I think one thing we could look at in terms of going forth from vijnana to jnana is thinking about one of the ways we divide in particular, which is dividing what we think is real from what we think is unreal. So the way in which we identify some things as real, others as unreal. So to give you some examples, dreams. How often do you wake up from a dream and then just assume, well, that was unreal, what I'm experiencing now in terms of waking consciousness, this is real. So there's dreams, there's novels, literature. We can read a book, can't we? We can get engrossed in the story. We can be living out all the emotions of the different characters, and then we close the book and put it down, and it kind of becomes unreal. But is that the case? You know, what's to say it was less real when we were actually living in the story? It's the same with the sutras. We can read a sutra like we're doing now. We can be inspired by it. We can imagine this whole world, this whole cosmos, if it's a Mahayana sutra, close the book, put it on the shelf, and it becomes unreal again. But is that the case? What about the effects that the sutra had on us while it was alive in our imagination? The other thing would be something like sadhana, or going for refuge and prostration practice, where we deliberately conjure up a whole world in our imagination. And for that time, it's kind of real to us. It's having an effect on us. But then we dissolve the image, stop meditating, go back to our daily routine. And we very easily slot things into the categories, don't we, of real or unreal. Is that true? Can we go forth a bit more from that kind of divided awareness? That's just a suggestion. Okay, so that then is a few words on going forth in body, speech and mind, emulating the Buddha and his progress towards enlightenment in terms of having a continual sense of going forth. Coming back to the sutta, you probably all know the story, but the next thing that happens to the Buddha is he goes and learns under two teachers, doesn't he? So Alara Kalama and Udaka Ramaputta. And he masters their teaching. Collectively they teach him to get even as high in terms of consciousness, levels of consciousness, as the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception. And the Buddha realizes that neither of their teachings lead him all the way to enlightenment. He can tell that there's still further to go. And he says in the text, not being satisfied, being dissatisfied, being disappointed, I left them. So in both cases, he leaves those teachers. Even when they offer him leadership of their communities, he decides to move on, to go. So this brings us to the third point. I'm not entirely sure what to call this one. I'll give you two things. So doing what needs to be done, or doing one's duty. So in the Buddha's case, doing what needed to be done meant leaving behind those teachers. So going forth again, recognizing that their teaching didn't lead to enlightenment, so he left them. I think for us, the opposite is true. So for us, doing what needs to be done is not leaving the Sangha behind. In the Buddha's case, what he discovered was that the communities he was participating in were, practicing a mundane teaching. It didn't lead to enlightenment. I think we can be confident that our community is practicing the Buddha's teaching, is practicing the Buddha's Dharma, and that does lead to enlightenment. It does contain the transcendental principle. So having confidence in that, we don't need to leave. It's all here. So for us, I think the opposite is true. We actually need to engage more with the Sangha, doing what needs to be done, doing one's duty by more fully engaging in the life of the Sangha. So rather than avoiding taking responsibility, I think the practice of the third ordination acceptance verse for us is to take responsibility within the Sangha, do what needs to be done. And Bhante, in his lecture, Enlightenment as Experience and Non-Experience, when he's describing the best way to regard enlightenment, he talks in terms of growth, work and duty. So growth, work and duty as the way to enlightenment. So I won't say anything about growth, but in terms of work, he speaks of the importance of finding creative work, work that makes us joyful. And the best work in that sense is work for the Dharma, whether that's teaching the Dharma or whether it's building Buddhist centres, building retreat centres, it's all work for the Dharma, and that's the most creative and joyful work we can do. With duty, he quotes Goethe. This is the quote. What is duty? The claims of the day. And how can a man know himself? By doing. Endeavour to do thy duty, and thou wilt at once know what in thee lies. So Goethe saying that we get to know ourselves by doing our duty. We talked a lot in our group this morning about how to get to know ourselves. That was one of Surita's points. If we want harmony, we need to know ourselves and we need to allow others to know us. I think the same is true with the third ordination vow. If we want to attain enlightenment, we need to know ourselves, absolutely, deeply know ourselves. And we get to know ourselves through doing our duty. So if we do take responsibility within the Sangha, that's what can happen. We can get to know ourselves much better, and therefore it helps us to move us in the direction of enlightenment. So one other thing to pick up on here is a way we can directly emulate the Buddha in his decision to leave his teachers behind is in that point that he doesn't want the status of leading their community. He's not interested in status. And I think that's something we can bear in mind. So in engaging with the Sangha, taking responsibility, doing our duty, we don't do that for status. The status of an order member is a non-status, Bhante once said. So not getting intoxicated with status, with kind of being the teacher, not over-identifying with our particular job or role within the Sangha. Simply and primarily being a Dharmachari, one who fares in the Dharma. Recognising that as our kind of principal identity, for want of a better term. So chapters are great for that, aren't they? Because in a chapter meeting, nobody's the chairman, nobody's the mitra convener, nobody's the teacher. You all come together on the basis of shared going for refuge. All of that is stripped away, if you like. You've just got the vital matter of the fact that you're all Dharmacharis going for refuge, sitting together and witnessing each other's going for refuge. Okay, so moving on in the story. So having been with his two teachers, the Buddha then decides neither of them work. He doesn't want to lead their communities. And he goes into a period of solitary striving. So I'll read you what he says in the text. So still in search, bhikkhus, of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, I wandered by stages through the Magadhan country until eventually I arrived at Uruvelar. There I saw an agreeable piece of ground, a delightful grove with a clear flowing river, with pleasant smooth banks and a nearby village for alms resort. I considered, this is an agreeable piece of ground. This is a delightful grove with a clear flowing river, with pleasant smooth banks and nearby village for alms. This will serve for the striving of a clansman intent on striving. And I sat down there thinking, this will serve for striving. So the Buddha describing his solitary striving, his decision to go it alone. So this is the fourth point. If we want to practice this third vow, is we have to be prepared to go it alone. Another way of putting that would be we have to become a true individual. So that's Bhante's terminology, isn't it? Becoming a true individual. And this description here in the text of the Buddha going forth again, going into solitude, it reminded me of two of the qualities of the true individual that Bhante's described. I recently found out that there's no definitive list of the qualities of a true individual. It just seemed to morph over time. But I've got a list of eight qualities of the true individual, which I'll read you. But the two that stand out in terms of what the Buddha's doing here is that the true individual is willing to go it alone, or is able to be alone. And the second one is you notice how aesthetically appreciative the Buddha was in his description of the scene, the whole landscape and what it was offering him. One of the qualities of the true individual is emotional positivity, being able to see with emotional positivity and having that aesthetic appreciation. So going it alone and aesthetic appreciation or positive emotion are two qualities of the true individual. The others on the list I've got here, these might make interesting discussion points, so I'll mention them briefly. The true individual is free of group conditioning. The true individual is aware. Able to be themselves. Not psychologically dependent on others. Accepts they may be unpopular. And has free-flowing energy. So maybe something to reflect on in that list there.
Could you say the last few again?
Accepting being unpopular. And free-flowing energy. So just bearing the whole list in mind, you can see those qualities in the Buddha. You can see those qualities in the Buddha even before his enlightenment to quite a high degree, as we've got evidence of here in this last passage. So ponder that list and just ask yourselves maybe what are the qualities, what are the areas that challenge us or that we could develop more of. So that's Bhante's list of the qualities of the true individual, or one of the lists of the qualities of the true individual. In more traditional terms, what we're talking about with that language of the true individual is stream entry. So that's the more traditional way of talking about what Bhante means when he's describing the true individual. So the stream entrant, this will be familiar ground, no fixed idea of a self, sees oneself as constantly changing. The stream entrant is wholly committed, wholeheartedly committed, and not treating the means as ends. And in early Buddhism, of course, the point of stream entry is the point of irreversibility. So in terms of how we approach enlightenment and the attainment of enlightenment, personally, I don't think, thinking in terms of stream entry and enlightenment, the language itself is problematic. Obviously, it belongs to the tradition. We must honour it and we must take it seriously, and there's no doubt a lot of value in it. There's a lotus in it, to use that image again. But I think it's more helpful for us to think in terms of going for refuge and the levels, Bhante's levels of going for refuge. The language of going for refuge is the language of a process. The problem with stream entry and enlightenment is that we tend to fix on them as particular points, things that we will attain. And that opens up two problems. One is that we think it's attainable and we launch a kind of smash and grab raid on it, where we add it to ourselves. Bhante says in that lecture on enlightenment as experience and non-experience that some people think enlightenment's like a flower that you put into your buttonhole. So that's one of the dangers of the language, where it's more static. The other is that you think it's unattainable, so you just kind of back off and leave it and forget it. Neither of those are options to us. There's no smash and grab raid on the transcendental, and we can't just sit back and ignore it, because how are we going to live out this third vow if we think it's impossible for us to attain either stream entry or enlightenment? So thinking in terms of going for refuge and the levels of going for refuge, I think, is much more helpful because it's a process. Thinking in those terms, it does avoid those extremes and those problematic ways of looking at things. There's no smash and grab raid, obviously, because it's a process, something that continues, deepens at deeper and deeper levels. And at the same time, you can't say you can't attain it because you're already doing it. So we're already going for refuge at some point on the scale. It's just a question of deepening what we're already doing. Okay, so coming towards a conclusion then, both of the Buddha story and the talk. So following his period of going into solitary striving, the Buddha achieves his goal. So the Buddha describes how he attained enlightenment. So he doesn't say very much about it. He says that seeing the danger in pursuing that which was conditioned, seeing the danger in that, understanding the danger in that, he attained nirvana. It doesn't say much more about it than that. Just that's what he was trying to do, and that's what happened. And I think that's quite significant in itself. There's no kind of flowery, elaborate descriptions in this sutta about what enlightenment is. He doesn't need to do that, does he? Because he sat there, presumably, talking to the bhikkhus. He's the evidence. He doesn't need to talk about it and what happened and what he saw in great detail. It's obvious that he's gained enlightenment. He doesn't need to kind of provide some kind of verification of that to them other than his own person and his own being. He is the proof. And for us, I think we can take something from that in the sense that we need to see the Buddha. It's not enough just to hear the descriptions of what might happen at the point of enlightenment, which can't tell us everything anyway, like I've said. We need to see the Buddha. We need to see the person of the Buddha, which obviously we can't do physically. The Buddha's not around anymore in the historical sense, but we can do that imaginatively. So the fifth point is to cultivate the imagination. If we want to put this third ordination acceptance vow into practice, we have to cultivate the imagination. So some people say they're not imaginative types, don't they? that they don't imagine, they're not very imaginative. I don't buy that for a second. If you're a human being, you've got an imagination and you use your imagination. You could say that we are imagination. It's just a question of how we use it. Arloka makes this point in one of the booklets in a talk he gave long ago, that we have this great beast of an imagination and we chain it down with the chains of our petty self-referential fantasies. So we're using the imagination all the time. The problem is we're often abusing it to pursue our self-referential petty compensatory fantasies. So we're using the imagination as an expression or a way of pursuing our greed, hatred, and an expression of our delusion. So the imagination is there, we're using it, it's just a question of training it. Because ultimately the imagination proper, as opposed to just self-referential fantasy, the imagination proper is the faculty that liberates us from our present experience of ourselves. So through imagination we can project ourselves beyond what we currently are. So if we're imagining the Buddha, let's say, or a Bodhisattva, we're imagining what a Buddha or a Bodhisattva is like. We're imagining their qualities. In a sense, we're bringing those qualities into being and lifting ourselves out of our current experience of ourselves, our limited sense of those qualities. We can lift ourselves out of those limitations and connect with something more developed. So many ways to do that. So there's Buddhanusati, recollection of the Buddha, bringing the Buddha to mind, looking at images of the Buddha. There's the going for refuge and prostration practice, which obviously not only has the Buddha, the historical Buddha in the centre, but all the archetypal Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and great teachers. There's the sutras and the suttas. Like I said before, if we open up one of these books, we're opening up a whole world that we can step into and inhabit. The Sutra of Golden Light calls itself a profound Buddha region. It talks about itself. It's not just a book. It's an entire world that we can enter into and inhabit with our imagination. And the more we do that, the more our imagination will come to life, the more it will have been fed by images that actually embody what enlightenment is and what enlightened qualities are. And there's puja as well. When we're saying those puja verses, we're imagining all the time images, symbols of enlightenment. We're inhabiting the consciousness of Shantideva, in a sense, given that the puja is derived from his Bodhicharyavatara. So of all the 5 points, perhaps this is the most important. I say perhaps because that could be a discussion point. I'm not going to stick my neck out and say it definitely is, but perhaps it's the most important. In a sense, the others make more sense in relation to the 5th point. So in terms of being honest, continually going forth, doing one's duty, and whatever the 4th point was, someone remind me, being prepared to go it alone. Was that it? Yeah. It all makes sense in the context of imagining the Buddha. If we can't imagine the Buddha and all the Buddha's qualities, why are we going to do any of those other things? So it really, really is crucial. There's a quote here from Buddhophany, which is in... it's one of the papers, isn't it? One of the 7 papers. A successful Dharma life requires an imaginative connection with the goal, some definite sense of reality beyond self-clinging. Without it, spiritual life becomes no more than a refinement of self-identity at best. So without that imaginative connection, that definite sense of reality that we're moving towards, spiritual life becomes no more than a refinement of self-identity at best. So imagination then is crucial. Cultivating imagination is crucial to practicing this 3rd ordination vow. That's using the language of imagination. We could use the language of faith. As far as I can tell, the more I reflect on imagination, the more I think it's synonymous with faith. The two are pretty much interchangeable. One is obviously from a Western tradition, the other is more traditional Buddhist terminology. But if you think of Bhante's definition of Shraddha as the ultimate in us responding to the ultimate in the universe, or Subhuti's talked about it as a responsiveness. Shraddha is a responsiveness to that which has value and meaning and true beauty. That sounds very much to me like what the imagination is. So we can talk about this also in terms of Shraddha. Cultivating Shraddha as essential to the attainment or the movement towards enlightenment. And actually that is the key faculty that the Buddha himself in the Aryaparyesana Sutta draws out, mentions. So after his enlightenment, again, you'll all know this part of the story, Brahma Sahampati appears before the Buddha and pleads with him to teach and to communicate the Dharma. He says there are beings with little dust in their eyes who will understand. They're wasting away from not hearing the Dharma. So the Buddha hears that. The Buddha then looks out with his imagination on the whole world of living beings, sees that they're like lotuses, all in different stages of development, some of them submerged in the muck, some of them forcing their way up, some of them poking out of the water, and he sees that it will be possible to communicate the Dharma to them. It will be possible. And then he says these words: open for them are the doors to the deathless. Let those with ears now show their faith. Open for them are the doors to the deathless. Let those with ears now show their faith. So the Buddha's calling upon people to show faith. In another translation, it's release their faith. And there's some dispute among the translators about what that verse means, but it could go either way. It could be release one's faith in that which is conditioned, or it could be release one's faith in order to connect with what's unconditioned. In a way, it doesn't matter, does it? It's the same point. And for us, it's an invitation from the Buddha to release our faith or release our imagination so that we can connect with his enlightenment. So then, just for the sake of completion, the Buddha concludes his life story to the bhikkhus by describing what happens then. So he goes forth again to communicate the Dharma. He meets Upaka, the wanderer, at first on the road, and tells him that he's an all-conquering universal victor. Upaka says, may that be so, and then just walks off. And then he gets to the deer park at Isipatana, meets his five former companions, his five friends, and as we know, he manages to communicate the essence of the Dharma to them, the guhya nature of the Dharma and his enlightenment. He does transmit that through words, through symbols, that is communicated to them. So there's a kind of sixth point, isn't there, that the Buddha is exemplifying there in what he does after enlightenment. And that kind of sixth point is do it for others. So all the other five points, again, only make sense in the context of this kind of sixth point, which is to do it for others. There's no such thing as a personal enlightenment. So we strive for enlightenment, not just for our own sake, but for the benefit of all beings. So this third verse, Maitreya Bandhu said, it's like the first and second are a build-up to this one. You could say that this one is also a build-up to the fourth one, or that it only makes sense in the context of all four of the ordination vows together. So that is the kind of sixth point. I'm going to leave it there, finish there, because that's where Maitreya Bandhu will pick up tomorrow, speaking about for the benefit of all beings, I accept this ordination.